Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on the Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and our total health environment. We explore a whole wide range of different facets of health and understanding, as well as community, public policy, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, and the health of our society. All of those issues that relate to our health, we talk about every week on Connect the Dots. And we've had a whole host of terrific guests on in the show in the past, everyone from Larry Dossey to conversations with Anthony Angrafia, who's been one of the leaders in the understanding the role of fracking in New York State, and a whole bunch of other interesting topics. In fact, I'm going to pull up some of our Connect the Dots archives and talk to you about that. The guest that we have planned for today's show is a really terrific guest that I'm so excited to have on the show, if in fact we are able to find him, because we're having a little trouble doing that right now. I'll tell you a little bit about that, and then we'll sort of chat, hoping he'll come along. If he doesn't, we'll discuss a whole bunch of other things. His name is Daniel J. Siegel, MD. He's the author of a book called Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. And actually, Dr. Siegel is an expert in both brain neurology, psychotherapy, and working with the mind, mindfulness and all of that. So he covers quite a broad range that's applicable both to teenagers and their parents, as well as to all of us lifelong. And I'm very much hoping that we'll be able to locate him so he can be with us. Meanwhile, there are just a few things that I kind of we can chat about in the interim, which I think will, you know, kind of keep us going here, hopefully. One of the things that's really exciting is we've had a number of recent shows on the building out of gas infrastructures. You know, as I've discussed in many of my blogs and articles on Alternet, the Huffington Post, and this radio program with countless guests, there's an issue both with fracking gas in local regions and the way the chemicals and air quality and indeed the energy both contaminate public sources, industrialize agricultural regions where our food comes from, as well as contribute to climate change. But one of the questions that's really important is, how do we stop this? How do we push forward, as President Obama wants to do, you know, with gas development, and, you know, and how do we actually slow climate change, which we desperately need to do, and come up with alternative and better renewable energy sources? So actually, there's an opportunity to find out more about that and to participate and weigh in, because in New York State, Governor Andrew Cuomo has proposed an energy plan for goals for greenhouse gas reductions, which is quite important, and there'll be 6 public hearings occurring all across the state. And this is an opportunity to both learn more about renewable energy and also to say no to frack gas, to ports for liquefied natural gas, to pipelines and compressor stations, which move across our state and contaminate air quality and public resources wherever you know they go. So this is a terrific opportunity, and you can go to all, you know, any of these places, whichever is near you, to both learn more and to submit a public comment and to speak out. You can also view the draft online if you're a New York resident at httpenergyplan.ny.gov. You know, and find out more about it. And also there'll be different, meeting places where you can go. In Albany, February 18th, Brooklyn, February 19th, Manhattan, February 20th, and on from there. So, you know, tune in, find out, and participate in this process, to make our energy what we need it to be to have a healthy planet. Moving along, I'm happy to say that we have our guest today with us, and I'm so thrilled to have him on the show. His name is Daniel J. Siegel, MD. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine and a co-director of the UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center, as well as executive director of the MindSight Institute. He's the author of numerous and co-author of a number of very interesting prior books on parenting and whole brain health, as well as mindfulness and the mindful brain. I've been aware of his work, and in fact met him at a conference, I guess, oh my gosh, it must be 8 or 9 years ago. I've long been a really big fan of his work, and so excited that he has this new book that's just out, and I think it's going to be so useful and needed for so many people. I was doing some blogging on the Take Part blog, talking to millennials who fall within the range group covered by this book, which is ages 12 to 24. The book is Brainstorm, his new book, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain, an inside-out guide to the emerging adolescent mind. So we'll be talking about that and how that relates both to teens, their parents, as well as all of us lifelong here with Daniel Siegel. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me on.
So delighted to have you here. You know, what really interests me about this book is that you're kind of weaving in and talking to both parents and teens simultaneously, as well as engaging, I think, any reader of the book, even if they're not currently raising or interacting with adolescents, and really thinking and understanding brain development and how it works and how who we are and how we evolve and how we create our strengths and integrate our ways of being is really mediated by the brain. And you so beautifully capture that. Before we kind of go any further, I would love to hear you just give that kind of basic understanding to readers of the role of the brain and why how we can develop it and why we want to think about that for anyone.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. You know, the challenge was how to write a book for both adolescents and adults, mm-hmm. and then describe in accessible terminology and concepts, you know, what the brain is all about and why it's important to know about it. So the first thing to say is that the reason to know about the brain, if you're an adolescent or an adult or even a child, is that what you do with your mind, how you focus your attention, the way you pattern your thinking, even the experiences you choose to engage in, all those kinds of experiences you have, either internally or externally, actually shape the structure of your brain. So we know this for a fact now, so we can actually learn skills to optimize how the brain grows and develops actually across the lifespan. So in the book, what I describe is the basic structure of the brain, you know, that it's composed of these basic cells called neurons. Their connections are called synapses, and the way you focus your attention, for example, is one form of experience, actually activates the neurons, it turns them on, it makes them communicate with each other. And as they are firing off like this, they actually can do a couple of things. They can strengthen their connections, they can even get new neurons to grow, and you can also lay down this myelin sheath that makes the interconnected neurons even more effective at communicating with each other. So all of this is basically the way we understand that from neuroscience, something called neuroplasticity. And so when you understand the basic parts of your brain, you can actually learn to understand your own inner mental experience better, how you relate to other people better, and even how to exercise your mind to optimize the structure of your brain. That's what
really?
I talk about in Brainstorm.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, it's really interesting. I had a longtime friend who for many years whenever one would, you know, I would share various stories of different things, people I knew, whatever, things that were happening, and her refrain was always, that's the way it is. That's just the way people are. He's like that, and he won't change, that kind of thing.
yeah.
And, you know, it's a very fixed view. And it kind of functioned in a very kind of grounding manner, but it also suggested just the opposite of what you're saying. In other words, that character is fixed. You know, all our way of thinking and perceiving is fixed. And you're saying that actually we could identify ways that that could change and optimize a little more. What are some of the basic ways that people, you know, kind of styles of functioning and weak areas of functioning that people might have and that they could identify and kind of compensate for?
Well, it's really interesting. There is a very general pattern that when you understand it, it's really great because then you can see what to do about it. So the simplest thing to say is that this whole function of the brain is to actually create what's called integration of functioning. Integration is a simple term, but what it means is you're taking different parts, like let's say Allison, you and I speaking together right now. We're talking with each other, and if we honor differences and then communicate effectively and compassionately, that would be an integrated relationship. We're having differences present and honoring them, and then we're linking each other. The same is true with the brain. If you have, let's say, a higher part of the brain and a lower part of the brain, they perform different functions, and you can learn about them, and then you can link them once you understand what each of them do. And the same is true with the left and the right side of the brain. And then there are a number of different ways you can understand integration in the brain. So here's the amazingly useful pattern that emerges, and this has a scientific basis, but it's also just what we see clinically when you see people in practice. When your life becomes chaotic, when it's like out of control and emotions are going wild, your thoughts are out of control, you can't focus attention, things are really you know, going up and down in your inner life, or when they're rigid, when they're unchanging, when you feel depleted, when things are stuck, when things are really boring, completely predictable. Those are the extremes, either rigidity on the one hand or chaos on the other, that actually come when the system of your brain is not integrated. Integration creates a flexible state that's really harmony. Like when you watch a choir and you hear them singing in harmony, that feeling of vitality you get is because the singers are differentiating their voices, they're doing harmonic intervals, and then they're linking together as they sing the same song. So harmony is really what integration creates. And the great thing about this is that when you learn, let's say, how your left hemisphere of your brain, the left side of your brain works, and the right side of your brain works, you can actually learn to honor the differences and actually cultivate them and appreciate them and enjoy them, but then learn how to link them. And when they're not linked, you can get either chaos or rigidity, or if you never really promote the differentiation of them, then they can also lead to chaos or rigidity if that's not happening. So that's the overall pattern, and I'm telling you this basic thing because when you look at what your friend said, you can say you're stuck in impaired integration. And yes, it's true. If you don't try on new skills of integration, you may stay that way your whole life. But the really, really exciting thing we know from neuroplasticity is if you intentionally focus your mind, and I've exercised in the Brainstorm book or in this other book I wrote called Mindsight, these exercises where you literally can identify parts of your life that, you know, are kind of chaotic or kind of rigid and find ways in which there may not be differentiation or linkage, and whether it's your left and right brain or your higher and lower parts or other aspects of brain functioning that we go through, and then actually focus your attention in a way that catalyzes integration and creates a more harmonious way of being in the world. And people look at you and they go, oh my God, your personality is changing. From the inside out, you just feel, this feels really good.
<laughs> You know? That's really funny. Personally, being a writer and everything, I have a lot of left brain functioning and a lot of mental, linear, I mean, there's nothing like being a journalist to get you sort of, you know, walking that narrow line of, you know, kind of one logical thought after another. That's the very nature of it. Actually, I think I'm a very right brain person natally, when I'm not doing that, but I've done a whole lot of that in life. And it's really, this is just a personal anecdote, but recently I've gotten into this thing where I like to do small hand-eye coordination things, like sewing, darning, putting nail polish on my nails, what does that do? Because there's something about it that is almost feels like the complement to all of the left brain structured writing activity that I usually
absolutely.
Am engaged with.
Well, let's take those two examples you gave. You know, the darning, you're using your left and right hand. So it's certainly hand-eye coordination, but it's also left, right, left, right, left, right. And even when you're doing your nails, mm-hmm. your right hand, which is controlled by your left brain, is doing your left hand, and then you
That's
flip
right.
around.
That's very true.
And, you know, people are finding, for example, a really great creative activity to do, even like doing an interview or if we could do it, is going for a walk. You know, and you do left, right, left, right, left,
That's right.
There's something very profound about involving both sides motorically of your body and
mm-hmm.
really getting involved in that. And I do the same thing. I actually love the juggle. And if I'm feeling stuck, you know, or something, I'll just pick up my, you know, my bean bags and I start juggling and all sorts of fun stuff gets released.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I was also thinking when you were talking about the harmony in the singing, because I come from a family with a lot of singing, actually.
Oh, wow.
I think that and we would sing along and with records and, you know, there were things everyone had memorized with different parts and everything, but also with the recent passing of Pete Seeger, who was such a beloved figure and felt like, an inspiration, a father figure, a role model to so many people, felt they had a personal relationship to him. Part of it is that he also came along with the Weavers, and they were singing these extraordinary harmonies. And
That's exactly it. You know, I remember when I first left California and moved to Boston for medical school, Pete Seeger was singing in Boston Symphony Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the concert with some people I had met, you know, I hadn't started school yet, but I had met earlier. And we went to the concert, and Pete, had everyone in this huge symphony hall singing and putting their arms around each other, people who didn't know each other, and just swaying back and forth throughout the whole concert. And you just felt this incredible, this is really such an incredible thing you're bringing up. You know, he brought out that everyone was unique and everyone was connected.
Mm.
And there's no better way of describing from an experiential point of view, you know, integration than what Pete Seeger used to do and what he still does in his songs. And that's, you know, that's such a beautiful thing, I think, to embrace as a way of life because, you know, we are differentiated. We do have these bodies we live in, but we're also profoundly interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's integration. And when you just look at one or the other, you lose this balance of the two. And you know, in some cultures, there's an emphasis on individualistic ways of living, and people feel very isolated. In other cultures, it's too collectivistic, and I say too, meaning it's mostly focusing on the togetherness of everything and no differentiation, and people feel kind of lost in that, too. And ideally, we could come up with a kind of a blend. I end the Brainstorm book urging the adolescent to consider, because they've been kind of exploring integration throughout the whole book, and I said, look, if you think about adolescence as the unfolding of identity, if you really want an integrated identity, we would really honor the reality that you have a body and you need to savor that as a me, but
mm-hmm.
we're also profoundly interconnected with other people on the planet, which is really a we, so if you had to remember it as one word, it would be mwe, M-W-E, you know? So then you could live with that kind of harmony. You could sing with other people. You could have your own song. You could, you know, and it just releases a lot of energy and a lot of possibility.
That's really, that makes me laugh. I'll tell you, because what immediately occurred to me when you said mwe was weem away.
Oh, yeah. Weem away,
weem away.
Yeah.
Like the
so
way of the we me, yeah.
Oh, and what does weem away mean?
Actually, I think I looked it up actually, because that particular song to me is like one of my absolute favorites, the whole song. Because it does harken back to the, you know, both the earth and the tribal roots, that we all are part of and come from and forget about, you know, in our individualistic emphasis in this society. And he calls that, it's like a call from the wild to that, interconnection. That's how I experience that particular song. So it actually, is a South African song, and I think it means something like lion, probably.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in I don't know if it's South Africa or Zambia, but in one of these southern African countries, mm-hmm. I think it's the Ubuntu, where they have a...
Oh, Ubuntu, yes,
where they
South
say,
African, yeah, Zulu.
What's that?
It's Zulu.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Zulu, where they say there's this this phrase they say that when you greet someone, you say, I see you, and mm-hmm. the person that you're speaking to says, I am here, and then they say, the one who said I am here says, I see you, and then the person says, I am here, as the seeing of the other creates the existence of yourself in many ways. And, you know, Helen Keller writes about this in her autobiography, where she says the moment she could have Anne Sullivan, her teacher, thrusting her hand in this water spigot and having her feel the wording of water, she felt her mind was born. There's something in this moment that we have shared connection, shared understanding, this linkage that comes from these previously completely differentiated parts, I think is what Helen Keller was really getting at. I would interpret that as, you know, this beautiful, poetic, incredibly profound developmental statement of how integration really creates us. And you had it in your family, you know, and yet we miss it in society, you know, this joining together of individual bodily selves into a collective whole where you can float beautifully between the connection, the differentiation, the connection, differentiation. We're too isolated these days, even with the internet. You know, Sherry Turkle's beautiful book, Alone Together, you know, it's all about our aloneness because we're so superficially connecting. We're not really deeply linking to each other.
Wow, that is so interesting and true. In fact, you know, I've been a health journalist for 25 years writing about personal health, and yet my work over the last 6 or 7 years, including this radio program, From Personal Health to Your Total Health Environment, and the book that I'm working on is all about the fact that health is actually both individual and collective, which it really is. You know, all of it. There's work we can do individually. We are individuals, but we're also connected and dependent on and interdependent with everything in our world, from, you know, the fundamentals that we need for life to the social containers and groups and tribes and nations and earthly container that we need for life, you know. So
exactly. Well, this is, you know, what's really beautiful about the many things you're saying, you know, is if we see the mechanism of integration within that relational way our self is created, it's fascinating to show, too, that the same process of integration that happens relationally actually happens neurologically.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know, so you see this really, it's really beautiful that, and the way to link them, for me anyway, is through energy and information flow. So as a journalist, you've been exploring how can you express information transmitted, let's say, if you're doing journalism on the radio, through sound waves or through print, you know, through photons of, you know, how people read words on a page or, you know, on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
So you have energy is what allows us to transmit information, and you've been really all about that. But if it's health journalism, I would say on different levels you've been dealing with integration, because I think integration is the basis of health. So what's really exciting about that is whether you're talking about culture or, you know, relatedness in communities or relatedness in families or even neurological function, integration actually works in every setting that we can find. We, meaning this field I work in, interpersonal neurobiology, and this book I wrote, Developing Mind, when I had these 15 interns work with me to revise the first edition, I said to them, let's prove that first edition is completely wrong. that integration has nothing to do with health, that it's all, you know, goofy ideas. Let's come up with something new and exciting and see what happens. And they looked at me and they said, what? What are you talking about? I said, yeah, in science, the idea is you put something out there and you say it's wrong. And, you know, that's the stance you take because you don't want to just assume that something that sounds okay is real. So they could not find a single piece of evidence to disprove the notion that integration is health. And all they could find was a ton of new supportive, empirically established research that suggests that integration and health go hand in hand. So it doesn't prove the proposal, and I'm laying it out here as a proposal so you and I and everyone listening can understand. It's just a suggestion, but so far there's a ton of research that supports that the suggestion may in fact be true. And when you realize that, then it's, you say, okay, as a health journalist, I would say you've been exploring the manifestations of integration or the lack of it.
Yes.
And then the healing process becomes, if you will, a way of becoming whole, where we interpret the word whole not as necessarily unified, but as integrated. Unified implies like homogeneous.
Mm-hmm.
We want to honor differences and promote linkages so that an integrated whole, if you will, is full of, as I went to this talk the other day of Andrew Solomon, who wrote, you know, Far From the Tree. And this is a paraphrase of what he said, but it was something like this. It was diversity, which is the differentiation. Diversity sustains and extends the ecosphere of kindness.
Wow, that is amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Unbelievable.
He either says sustains or extends. I don't know which one, so I'll give him both. but both can fit. But it was that idea, and I thought it was so beautiful. Now, he didn't mention the word integration because, you know, this is kind of a conceptual idea that comes from this other scientific stuff I do. But in his talk, it was fitting perfectly into it. So even as a community, we want to do that. And even in the brain, and I do this with the adolescent because this blew my mind. You know, I have two kids who are now in their early 20s, and they went through their teen years, but they're still adolescents because adolescence goes in the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
So when I wrote Brainstorm, I wanted to write something so that, you know, if anyone was an adolescent, they themselves could read a book about their own brain and the importance of integration in their relationships, even their relationship with their own nervous system. And what was exciting about that was to say, I'm going to review all the research on the adolescent brain, which is about 12 to 15 years old. So it's not that much of a period of time, so you can review it. And when I did, the amazing thing that emerged was, number one, no one understood that, unlike a child who is just sort of like a sponge absorbing things in the first dozen years of life, the brain is accumulating more and more synaptic connections and refining itself as it learns skills and stuff. But at 12 years of age, on average, when adolescence begins, there's this pruning that happens, which like shocked everyone. Like, why is the brain cutting itself down, destroying itself intentionally? It's happening across all these kids that were being studied as they went through adolescence. And then not only was it pruning, but then there's this intense myelination, which is where you take the remaining neurons and their connections, the ones that are linked to each other, you myelinate them, and myelin allows the way neurons communicate to become 3,000 times not only fast, but coordinated. So overall, what you're doing, this is the amazing, this is what blew my mind. I'm reading it, and it says, the purpose and the power, if you will, and these are my words, but the purpose and the power of this remodeling, this pruning and myelination, is actually, and here it goes, to increase the integration of the brain. Because you're differentiating with the pruning, and you're linking with the myelination, and ultimately, and it's a little bit different timing, males a little bit later than females, but they end up the same place. Ultimately, what you're doing is you're creating more integration in the brain. So what I said was, wow, I've been working on all these empirically inspired skill trainings that you can do to increase integration in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So why not offer it to adolescents as a way to strengthen the remodeling that's going on, so that with all the stress that people have, which we think may worsen the pruning process, which can really lead to vulnerable circuits being exposed.
Mm-hmm.
Why not actually give everybody and schools and families the opportunity to actually do the mind training that builds integration, so that as you go through this remodeling period, you're going to be really good to go by optimizing integration.
That's amazing. I mean, actually, that sounds absolutely fantastic. When you were talking about myelination, I was thinking, well, if there was a myelination pill,
everybody would take it.
Everybody would take it. Yeah.
And you know what it's called? It's called mind practice. Doing a practice with your mind. That's actually what builds myelin. That's the pill.
So you're talking about meditation and all of those.
Meditation would be one really great example of a mind training practice. So practice meaning you repeat an exercise, you know, over and over again. The mind being, in the way I define it, this process that governs the movement of energy and information. And the way you do that is with attention. So meditation would be the intentional guiding of information and energy flow through your awareness in a systematic way. That's just an elaborate way of saying mind training, but that's what meditation means. That's all it means, is you're training the mind. And we now know from empirically studied groups of people that you can systematically guide the focus of attention to change the structure of the brain in integrative areas of the brain. And the reason why integration in the brain is important is that it allows the coordination and balance of this very complex system. So it allows it to work in harmony rather than being prone to chaos or rigidity. That's it.
That is so interesting, because I also, you know, I'm really also, because I always do the bridge for health and for our greater health of our, you know, for everyone's health, of all living beings of the earth and all of that. I'm always looking at public policies and our roles as citizens, enacting on the populace and, you know, making decisions as a society and what we make our priorities out of, as well as in the media, how we come to understand the things that we need to further, for the furthering of public health. You know, that's kind of my constant theme. So I'm always looking at, how we in the media talk about the different areas of dispute, disagreement, or lack of clarity, in a way that, promotes people's understanding as citizens. And it's really fascinating, that, you know, so often what happens is polarization and rigidity, you know.
There you go.
In the conversation,
yeah.
Which actually reflects, you know, another, at the social level, you know, the dysfunctions that we are prone to on an individual level. So
well,
doing
Allison,
what you're describing
yeah.
would lead to better citizenry.
Totally. I mean, you know, what you're describing is so fantastic because, you know, if you take that conversation you're having with someone, inviting them to consider, you know, an additional point of view, and I'm not saying alternative, like replace theirs, just to think that there are other points of view.
Mm-hmm.
That requires that you differentiate and say, wow, I have an opinion, and you have an opinion, and they both have merit.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'll stick with mine, but I respect yours. That's a totally different way of living than saying, my way is the only way, and go away, you know, take to the highway if you don't take my way, you know, all that stuff. You know, then you see the rigidity, or you see people exploding with anger and killing each other. So integration, amazingly, when you think about cultural issues or political issues or even planetary issues, I got to say, integration is a fundamental concept of health that can carry you between society and synapses. It's really, really interesting. And once we have this, you can say, well, where does this come from? You know, I'll just say for any listeners who like want to know the background, you know, when you try to embrace some fundamental challenges like what is the mind, which I've been trying to wrestle with for the last decade, or you know, 2 decades really, where you say, okay, well, if the mind is, yes, an embodied process that includes the brain, but it's not just in the head, it's the whole body, that we know. Some people disagree with that, but let's just take that stance first. And then you talk to an anthropologist or sociologist or political scientist or historian or a journalist, even you say, well, of course, our mental lives, our feelings, our thoughts, they're influenced by our relationships. So you say, okay, well, then the mind must be relational too. So you go, what is that shared in common? And then you come, there's a long line of reasoning. I talk about this in the Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology, but I'll just give you the take-home message is this. When you look at the fact that the mind is both relational and embodied, you see that energy and information flow is what those two processes, relational processes and body processes, share in common. And then you say, and this is where there's a bunch of science behind what I'm about to say, but there's an emergent self-organizing process that comes from this complex system of, in this case, energy and information flow that's both within us and between us. And what I've suggested is this self-organizing process is what the mind is. Beyond subjective experience and consciousness and other aspects of mental life, this is a third aspect that is self-organizing. And the reason I bring all that in is it is the link to the mathematics of complex systems that says linking differentiated parts of a complex system is exactly how self-organization optimizes the movement of that system to be the most flexible, adaptive, and coherent. And then you go, wow, that's a pretty cool definition of health. And then you can make that suggestion, okay, well, the linkage of differentiated parts, even though mathematicians don't use in this way, the way we're using integration, they use it for addition, but we're using it for this more complex way of saying you honor differences and maintain the differences, and you link. So we're not, integration is not the same as homogenization. This is really important to say, because people think, oh, it's just, you know, blending it all together. No, integration is not the same as blending. It's honoring differences and then creating these effective, respectful, compassionate linkages. And when you do that, you know the phrase, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts? That's integration in a nutshell. And that's what harmony is in a nutshell. And so it's not addition, so it's integration. So here's the key thing. The mind as a self-organizing process optimizes the well-being of the system we're talking about by linking differentiated parts, by having integration at its core. When it's not there, it's chaos or rigidity. When it is there, when integration is moving, it's always a dynamic, fluid process. It is harmony. And so then you have the whole thing in a nutshell. I wanted you to have the background so you can see why there's a huge amount of conceptual science, a huge amount of empirical science supporting this proposal that integration is health, period, whatever level of system you're looking at.
Well, what I love about it is that by virtue of the fact that it's a relational model, it builds out to encompass these other things, whereas as someone who began, you know, studying yoga and all those kinds of practices and orientations many decades back, it was always, you know, like the yogi on the mountaintop kind of thing, or, you know, floating away to eternal cosmic consciousness and then leaving the troubles of Earth behind, you know, and renouncing them kind of thing. It was
aesthetic kind of.
Yeah, it was ascetic, or it was like monadic. It was like a solo model, you know, that wasn't relational back to, it didn't have flow forward toward other people, more complex systems, and the whole context and milieu in which we are living and embodied and everything, where the model that you're describing, that adds the component that makes it, that builds it out into our world rather than being a kind of pleasant escape from it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I love this, and I hope we'll do a book together.
Well, that would be exciting. You know, some book, and I've got so, you know, what was funny about writing this in the adolescent book was these ideas, you know, to make sure a 13-year-old could read them who hasn't experienced that as much life, let's say, as an 18-year-old or 24-year-old or 54-year-old who might be reading it. You know, I wanted to make sure these concepts were really straightforward and clear.
Mm-hmm.
And yet by the end, you know, when the reader goes on the journey as we go through it, as I mentioned, this mui thing, you know, even a word like self, we talk about, you know, integration and all this stuff. We talk about the development of identity. So you say, well, who is myself? So what I say to the reader at the end is I say, you know, basically there's no reason that that word self has to have its boundaries at the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just an assumption,
mm-hmm.
that I live in a body, so therefore myself must be in my body. So I said, yes, of course, you have a bodily experience of an embodied life, an embodied identity. Absolutely. And savor that, enjoy that, take care of it, keep it healthy. But yourself is just as much relational. You're just as much connected to people in your life or people on the planet or the whole planet as you are living in this skin. And
Yeah. Let me ask you something about this current generation in relation to this, because they are much more group-oriented in terms of their relational style than prior generations have been. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about, you know, the virtues and downsides of that and what kind of, you know, people that's breeding in terms of this whole generation that's coming along.
You know, it's so fascinating because people often say the opposite. They go, oh, this new generation is so selfish, they're so self-involved, they're so narcissistic. And I say just what you say. I say, look at the research. The millennials are actually, when they go to work, they're very interested in making sure their work is giving back to society. They're very interested in this group orientation, as you're saying. Now, that's on the level of feeling a part of the planet, and it gives me unbelievable hope and optimism that, you know, we can use the power of this emerging adolescent courage and creativity that is arising in the young people of the world to actually realize how interconnected we are. That's that part. If you're talking about they're more group-oriented, like they don't take much time for self-reflection, and there's so much on social media that they're constantly, you know, updating their status, and, you know, it's so surfacey. Which kind of group thing are you talking about? Because that's there, too.
All of it. And also, their relational style in terms of partnering and mating seems
very different. Yeah, in terms of hooking
different.
Up and things like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. On one level, and this is really building on some studies of just how the social media is impacting people, there is, I think, a feeling that can be summarized something like this: I share, therefore I am. And there's been so much of a focus on, you know, the giving of details out into the large, you know, sphere of social media, that you then get a response back with thumbs up or different clicks or all the things you get that give you some feeling like you exist, right? Because you shared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is very externally focused.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't that much what I call time in. There's not taking time to reflect inwardly where you are in touch with literally your heartfelt feelings, your gut feelings, this bodily set of data. So I call that vertical integration, because you're literally taking your higher cortex and bringing in the data from your body. So it's vertically differentiated and linked. Because this is not a development of this vertical integration, I think there's a more of a focus on how do I know I'm even here? How do I know I exist? If you don't feel the depth of your heart and the depth of your intestines, your gut feelings, there's going to be a floatiness to your sense of reality. So then you look at your screen, and your screen says you have 3 texts from friends, and they're chatting with you, and they want to FaceTime with you, and you want to update your status, you want to show your photos. And I see it not just in adolescents, I see it in adults all over the place. I'll see adults walking with their young child in their arm from school, walk an entire block, and never communicate with their kid. It's just unbelievable to me. Everyone is drawn to these screens because I think it's, I share, therefore I am. And that's why, I don't know how it is where you are, but in California, we have these big computer signs on the freeway that say, don't text while you drive. You know, because, you know, texting, you're like drunk. You're just, you're driving about as effectively as if you were drunk. So why do people do that? I think what happens is, you know, you get a little sound or something goes off on your phone, it buzzes, and you know someone is trying to connect with you, someone's trying to share with you, and you could share back. So you quickly grab it as you're driving, and there's this shaky feeling like, I've got to respond to them now, because I think people are feeling like the only time they're ever real is when they're sharing.
Mm.
So even though they're driving this two-ton weapon down the street, it's like, you know, a relative of mine was, his whole family is almost wiped out. Their car was destroyed. They all got out of the car safe, thank God. But, you know, the woman gets out of her car. She wasn't an adolescent. She was like 50 years old. She gets out of her car. She says, "I'm sorry, I was on the phone."
Oh, my gosh.
She just ran a red light. "I'm sorry, I was on the phone." First of all, why she'd be on the phone, that's terrible. Then how she thought it would be okay to say to people she almost killed, "I'm sorry, I was on the phone." I mean,
oh,
like,
my God.
What?
Yeah, right.
So, but it's that kind of thing. I think so in terms of the group thing that way, I think when people feel so not in touch with their inner life, then sharing, connecting that way has a desperate feeling of establishing some kind of existential reality that you are actually alive and you exist. And that's the, I think that's the life and death feeling you may be picking up, you know.
Well, it also sounds like an aftermath of social breakdown. In other words, there aren't the grounded, present in community, sort of activities, relationships, connections, in a physical plane, in a space, in a neighborhood, in a community, all of those things may be lacking. Parents may be distracted due to the economic pressures and other things, and so, you know, marriages break down, all kinds of things happen, and so then people seek this out and glom onto this to replace lost forms of social connection and societal caring, perhaps even.
I think it's totally true. And, you know, I think the amazing moment we have is if, let's say you just go have the willing suspension of disbelief and say, okay, integration is well-being. So if people are so not differentiated in their own bodies and don't know themselves, they're desperate somehow to get connected to signals from other people just to feel like they're real. Mm-hmm. This is going to be really pushing us toward rigidity on the one hand, or other things like chaos. I mean, the cyberbullying that happens, the things that go on that are actually quite violent,
mm-hmm.
You can actually see these emerging from exactly what you're saying, the societal breakdown in integration. You know, where you honor differences and you promote linkages both within yourself and between you and other people and you and the whole world. So what's really beautiful about the moment we're at is we now know with intention you can actually bring, like you're doing in this radio program or in journalism in general with the media, you can now think about deeply what well-being is about for our whole human family. And then try to change the cultural conversation. In this case, in Brainstorm, I'm talking about adolescence, but here we're talking about our whole way of living. And you change the cultural conversation, that alters, you know, cultural evolution
mm-hmm.
with intention toward integration. And when you do this, the beautiful thing is the way we are changing as a species now is not so much through biological evolution with the gradual mutation of genes and the selection of those characteristics expressed from those genes that are the most, have the most survival value, the most adaptive, and over the generations, okay, those who reproduce that way get better. This, the kind of change we're seeing now is actually not that kind of genetic evolution.
Mm-hmm. If anything, we have genetic devolution.
Well, it could be, absolutely. Well, that's true, too. Mm-hmm. But we're having the speed at which we're changing, and I've talked to lots of historians about this. It isn't just our impression that the nature of life is changing faster mm-hmm. and faster for humans and for the planet. It's actually a reality. It's not just a subjective feeling, oh, my God, it's going so quick. As we know, we're getting more information streamed to us, just as one example, in a week than 100 years ago someone might have gotten, I think, in a lifetime. That's how much stuff is bombarding us. So, cultural evolution is how human beings change. Now, the downside of that is it can change really fast. The upside is it can change really fast. If we use intention, we can get to change in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm.
So, something like mindfulness, for example, which is a very integrative practice, mm-hmm. when practiced relationally, you get a win-win situation. Something like taking time in and let's say adolescence. If we think about the integrative processes that are happening in the remodeling of the adolescent brain. And we realized that parents and teachers and anyone else, therapists, anyone, coaches, mentors, anyone supporting an adolescent's growth and adolescents themselves can actually begin with intention to create more integration in their lives. And that means in their nervous systems, including their brains, and in their relationships. Then there's really a chance here to move our cultural evolution, which sadly is including all this climate change problem, including, you know, issues about fracking you were mentioning earlier, and all the other things that actually, everything is interrelated. This is the thing. Everything is interconnected. So when you work at, let's say, creating deep levels of integration, beginning with an adolescent, where she or he can emerge during this period of courage and creativity, being told the truth, that the myths that, you know, raging hormones are driving them mad, or, you know, it's just a period of immaturity, or, you know, they just got to get through it because it's such a horrible time. Those are all myths that are not only misleading because they're wrong, but they're destructive and disempowering. If we could actually clarify with the truths, which I tried to do in the Brainstorm book, and say, hey, we as adults can support adolescents in this essence that emerges. You know, I talk about the spells the word essence, emotional spark, this passion that's there. S-E is social engagement, that they're programmed, literally biologically programmed, to connect now more with their peers as they start to push away from their parents. N is novelty, you know, the way the brain is changing and the reward circuits pushes it towards trying new things, and even the change in the evaluative circuits let you focus on the thrilling parts of a choice and de-emphasize the downside. That means there's a risk. There's downsides to each of these things. You can get and hurt. But the upside is you have the courage to try something new that may be risky, of failure.
Mm-hmm.
And the final thing, CE, this all spells the word essence, creative exploration. You know, our species has this amazing period called adolescence where biologically we are programmed to push away from the status quo. And, you know, as the world changes, we need the courage and creativity of adolescents to really adapt to a new world. And the other thing is, we as adults, if we hold on to this essence, this is the way we can live a vital life and keep our brains young and keep connected to the world. And it's a win-win
situation. And that's why this book is so relevant to everybody. Again, the book we're talking about today is Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. But really, it's a great read for everyone of all ages. Whether you're a parent, a teen, or just anybody. I've gotten so much from reading this book and from this conversation with Daniel J. Siegel, M.D. And you can go to his website, www.drdansiegel.com. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots. Wonderful. Wonderful talking to you, and good luck with the book. I hope everyone reads it. And thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we'll be back with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.